Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles range. We have your van.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
I'm joined in the studio now by Dr. Colm Henry, who's the Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE. You're very welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Everyone wants to know what's happening with Level 5, and you know those reports are around the place this morning about the NPHET letter. You're a member of NPHET that have gone. The letter has gone, apparently, we're told, to the Minister for Health, recommending again that we go to Level 5. Is that the case?
Well, clearly NPHET, as always, will make its recommendation to government, and government will make the response as it's charged to do, taking into account the broader considerations of the impact of society on the recommendations coming from NPHET. So I'm not going to comment further on that because it has to go through its proper governance and its proper consideration before government decide what they're going to do. What I would say, Claire, is that government ourselves share a significant concern. I'm not here just as a member of NPHET, I'm here as Chief Technical Officer of the HSE, and we're very concerned at the trends we're seeing in Ireland in the context of what we're seeing all over Europe. Over Europe the past week, 100,000 new cases per day, upwards 30-40% in the previous weeks. We're now seeing the impact on other countries that are ahead of us, if you like, in their experience of this second wave, with impact on hospitalizations, on intensive care units, and tragically deaths. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing the same trends here, and the projections, there's no reason we would not expect our projections to be any different from what's happening in mainland Europe.
And have things become much worse since almost two Sundays ago now, when NPHET requested that we go to Level 5? Because the projections then were that it would get very serious. But now it seems that we've surpassed that point.
But clearly at the time, there were trends that were becoming clearer. There was a fog lifting over some of the figures, and the trends were becoming very clear. What we're seeing now is certainly a clearing of that kind of data to give a much more definitive picture of where we're going. And in short, what we're seeing is the projections of exponential growth of cases, the projections of exponential growth in hospitalizations are in some cases being exceeded. And we've seen that in border counties. So to give you an example, Claire, we know last night we had 235 cases of COVID confirmed in hospitals. We had 8 at the beginning of August. We have 29 in critical care units versus 6 at the beginning of August. We've a two-week instance, and this is the currency of our discussion on COVID, is what is a two-week instance figure. It has now surpassed 200 in Ireland. It was 3 at the end of July. And the positivity rate, we're testing more than ever before, nearly 100,000 tests per week. The positivity rate has now gone over 6%. We were below 1% in July.
Yeah, I'm just reading the Irish Times, though, from the HSE briefing, and you were speaking at that last night. 4 out of 5 of those positive cases are asymptomatic. Now, what do we read into that?
We've always known that most cases are asymptomatic or have mild symptoms. But in broad terms, if I could explain to your listeners, for every 1,000 people who test positive for this virus, between 30 and 50 will require hospitalisation, and between 3 and 5 will require ITU care. So earlier on in our experience with this virus, we weren't able to test at the volumes we needed. And for every one case we were identifying, maybe we were missing 1 or 2 more cases. Now, with the scale of testing that we have, the volume of testing, well over 1.3 million tests having performed, sometimes repeatedly in the same people, as I said, now approaching 100,000 tests per week, we're confident we're identifying nearly all cases. So that translation of positive cases identified through to hospitalisation and through to ITU is more or less consistent, as it is in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice how busy the roads were this morning? I don't know if you've travelled much around the city today, but normally on a Friday morning, it's a bit quieter. It was really busy again this morning. It was really busy yesterday morning. I mean, people aren't listening.
It is, but it's understandable. I was listening to your previous, to Anthony O'Connor being interviewed from Talla Hospital, and he talked about us grieving the life we had. And there was such a monumental society effort, this Mehel spirit in that phase one.
And that's gone now. It does appear to be gone.
I don't agree it's gone. I think there was such a sigh of relief that we felt we had avoided the scenarios we saw in Wuhan and Bergamo. We saw in those healthcare systems completely overrun, a very well developed healthcare system in the north of Italy, overrun, unable to provide the quality or standard of care it normally would do when it became overwhelmed with COVID cases. And we avoided that scenario thanks to everybody's effort. And I suppose there's understandably a huge sense of fatigue in people at the spectre of facing another surge in cases. But I would say, and my message always has to be one of hope, because it is possible to avoid that scenario again. If we do nothing, If we do nothing, we do face numbers of cases by the end of October, beginning of November, which will lead to hospitalizations and intensive care usage that no healthcare system could deal with.
I know at the moment you're trying to keep the non-COVID care open, the elective surgeries happening. Mm-hmm. Are you getting to the pinch point now where you might have to start looking at reducing at the very least the other care, the care outside of COVID?
Our challenge now is much greater than before. In March or April, what we did was almost configure our whole healthcare system to a COVID healthcare emergency strategy, where we wiped the slate clean, where we stopped and paused all non-essential care. And we, as a result, people, we had lots of empty acute beds. We had space in our critical care units. Thankfully, we never had to lean into that surge capacity we developed. But at the cost of suspending activities that we know that suspension caused harm to particularly vulnerable people. Now we have to restart those activities, which we have done. We have to get cancer attendance figures, people attending rapid access cancer clinics, people attending screening. We have to get them back up to figures that make these programs viable and useful and valuable, and at the same time suppress COVID. If
Yeah, I'm just wondering what you're seeing now as you look at the numbers rising. Are you thinking to yourself, we can't hold the line here with the non-COVID care much longer, or are we quite a way away from that point?
I would say the greatest threat, this widespread uncontrolled community transmission that we're seeing now, represents the greatest threat to our healthcare services. It would be impossible for us to continue all the full spectrum of healthcare services if we become overwhelmed with COVID and COVID suspect cases. And it would be prove increasingly difficult for schools to maintain open with those levels of community transmission. And it would be impossible, with all the best defences in the world, with the best infection prevention control, the best training, the best protection, the best level of awareness, the best testing, the best public health outbreak management, it is impossible to prevent the virus entering most vulnerable settings, including nursing homes.
So how long have we got?
We have, I think it is a very short, we keep saying about a small window. This is a very small window now. And the deeper we get into this, the harder it is to turn it round. I still believe we can turn this round. We're seeing figures that are very high. Even if we all completely comply and adhere now, it will take a number of weeks for this to turn round. But in my view, we have no choice.
Mm-hmm. Will it happen under level three restrictions? Given what you've seen with your own eyes, in your own daily life, will we get there as things are right now?
What we saw, there's two ways of looking at this. One is the restrictions itself and what to do. And the second is people's behaviour. And the more I, certainly from my experience going into this crisis, I have huge more respect for public health as a specialist, but also for people who, behavioural scientists, who look at how individuals and populations respond. So looking at the level three by the letter of the law, it should have effect. And you could see the effect in Dublin. It slowed the rate of growth. A reduced number of contacts per case identified. Do you remember it was used to be six for every case? Now it got down to three. So people were listening. But you mentioned yourself, Claire, what you see in Dublin and what I see as I live in Cork, which is Ireland's greatest city, as you know, but the second greatest city, I see people, a sense of awareness, but also mixed with a sense of denial. And so clearly, and behavioural scientists would tell you that there's a fatigue there.
So we're trying to get away with stuff here and it's not working.
Not all, but there is after what we've gone through, after what we achieved, it's understandable. But clearly the level three, it's hard to see based on the evidence that's emerging at level three, and people's response to it will be enough to turn this round.
Do you think people are confused at level three? Or that it's easier to bend the rules at level three than it might be if you were at level five?
I think it's, for us, we all could speak as individuals as how we individually respond to the repeated message and to the warnings that people are given. But I think it's more people don't always link it to. Back in March and April, we were seeing very emotional scenes in other healthcare systems overrun that scared people. And there was a fear motivation there. And we know that fear, whether it's asking someone to give up cigarettes or whether it's any other individual action, there's a law of diminishing returns. And you don't want to motivate people by fear. You want to motivate people to, as I say, belong to one societal effort to turn things around for everybody's benefit, particularly vulnerable people who are not, just to counter this myth, are not some other group of people that can mind themselves.
But from what you're saying, we may not have the time for the niceties of being able to mobilise people by, you know, asking for them to present a united front. We just might not be there. Might be gone past that point very quickly.
Clearly, what is needed now, to be clear about this, with the levels of community transmission we see, which will inevitably translate through to those figures I told you about hospitalizations and ITUs, there is no healthcare system can withstand overwhelming community transmission. It can't do that. No, we saw that in the north of Italy. We've seen it elsewhere. We have built up our public health system. We built up our testing and tracing from nothing. But it's none of these, nor our critical care units or acute hospitals, configured to deal with overwhelming.
I'm trying to figure out a way to ask you this. And I know that you don't want to get involved in the political side and what the government are going to do and all the rest. What will happen if the government again says no to level five? Can you answer that question?
I understand the challenge. I'm here as an individual as well as a doctor. And I understand the huge challenge because I'm very aware, both as an individual and as a doctor for the Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE, of the huge harm that was done to people as a consequence of the lockdown. We have studies that we did with paediatricians. We have looked at the effects on older people, which showed effects on people's mental health, their well-being, their delayed opportunities to seek healthcare, delayed presentations of illness, delayed presentations of potential cancer symptoms. So I'm very aware of the conflicting counter risks that we face, and government have an even bigger canvas to work off, which is how do the economy with joblessness, with the despair that follows, and with the difficulty of building up these businesses again. This is no easy task. Every country is struggling with it.
Yeah,
every country.
I know. And you know, one of the things we're looking at on this programme all the time is how other countries are dealing with it. And I know that every country is struggling. But from your point of view, you're telling me this morning that the hospitals are going to get overwhelmed if we don't do something. And it would appear from what we've just been talking about that level three is not working. So what position are you and your staff going to be put in if we don't lock down?
Before I go that clear, I want to assure people overwhelmed is a very strong verb. Mm-hmm. Our hospitals are accustomed to developing surge plans every winter, long before COVID. That's what they're doing now. They're looking at how they can create additional beds. They're looking at creating additional rehabilitation beds. They're looking at the whole pathway of care to avoid hospital admission, to speed people's journey through hospital and to expedite discharge. In the case of intensive care beds, we have a surge capacity plan in place that would provide the same quality of care with redeployed personnel up to way over our core number of beds. So the idea of our hospital system being overwhelmed, it would happen certainly if we saw unmitigated exponential growth, which is not going to happen, because I'm confident that decisions will be made, population decisions will be made to make sure that we reverse the trends we're seeing, because we have no alternative.
Are we seeing unmitigated growth right now?
We're seeing widespread community transmission. And to be clear again, that represents a very real threat to our hospital system, to our nursing homes, and to all elements that we've built up, including testing and tracing and public health.
I don't know if you have this off the top of your head now, but which hospitals this morning are under pressure? Because we've heard about Cork, we hear what's going on in Cavan. Can you give us a rundown of what's going on nationally?
Well, each hospital has a different story. Clearly in Cork, there was a surge in presentations. There was also loss of some beds due to isolation, infection control. And they've responded down there, working within the hospital and community to create alternative pathways, additional beds, and to make sure, because we can't default to the same situation we often did, which was trolleys, people staying cheek by jowl in trolleys. In the case of Cavan and the border counties, clearly those two-week transmissions of 500, 600 per 100,000, a great concern. And in a relatively small hospital, a small increase in critical care beds can have a big impact. What I would say is these hospitals don't work in isolation anymore. Mm-hmm. They're part of hospital groups. And Cavan Hospital, for my own native county, is part of the RCSI hospital group, ably led by Ian Carter, and he operates that hospital as part of a family of hospitals, and we were able to work and use the resources of other hospitals in that group, including Beaumont Hospital, for example, to transfer patients if necessary, if critical care is exhausted in one hospital.
Okay. The flu vaccine, I know that the pharmacists were out during the week saying that they still can't access enough flu vaccine and that people are crying out for it. Can you tell me what's happening there with the supplies?
Overall headline figures, Claire, we ordered 1.4 million of the flu vaccines for those high priority groups, including healthcare workers and those with chronic disease, older people and pregnant women and so on. Last year, we had one, that's a 20% increase from what we had last year.
No, I'm not talking about how much you ordered, how much here and has been delivered and can we get our hands on? Look,
at this point, 75% of our total stock for this year has been delivered. Okay. And by mid-October, by that third run, it'll be 90%. And we had some delay with that third run, which means we'll have a fourth run running into later in October, by which time we will have delivered our 1.4 million. And bear in mind, last year...
Is that enough, the 1.4 million?
It's a 40% increase on the uptake of last year. But what makes things different this year is the demand is much greater, which is a good thing. That's what we want. We want demand to be much greater among healthcare workers. Bear in mind, it's only a few years ago the uptake in healthcare workers was 25-30%. Now it's 60%. We need it to be much higher.
So are you confident that the 1.4 million is going to be enough to meet demand?
I'm confident based on uptake and projections and based on how we look at each of those groups that we'll have enough for demand.
Can we get any more if we need it?
Unfortunately, the way these the vaccines are manufactured and ordered based on the epidemiological data and the nature of the viruses, the flu virus is seen in the southern hemisphere. That's done much earlier in the year, so that ship has sailed, I'm afraid.
Okay, we can't get any more.
That's what we have, and that's what we're dealing with.
Okay, when it comes to level five, it seemed that the advice in the schedule for the levels changed when it came to schools, because level five initially said that schools could remain open. Then it said subject to medical advice. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that schools should remain open under level five?
I believe there has to be a purpose to what we're doing. And the three core purposes of what we're doing is obviously to protect vulnerable people, to protect our healthcare services, and to protect schools. I personally believe, and I would be advocating for this, that we should keep schools open as long as possible, bearing in mind that the single biggest threat to schools is widespread community transmission, not the other way around. Contrary to some of the commentary we've seen, schools themselves are not a great feeder through to community transmission. And we've now tested over 9,000 staff and students in school settings, the positivity rate only 1.7%, contrasting to the one I gave you earlier for the wider community of 6.2%. So what we're seeing are cases in schools. We're seeing most outbreaks. The trend and the analysis shows that the most likely source of most of these outbreaks is the community and not within the school itself. And ongoing transmission from the school setting doesn't appear to be a major problem, reflecting what the experience was in Denmark, who opened their schools at an earlier phase in this trajectory than ourselves.
But you can probably understand, you know, how teachers would feel apprehensive if the whole country's told to stay at home and they're told get into your car there and go to work.
Of course I understand that. And I would like to acknowledge the huge work of schools, principals, including the school I was once chair of in Cork, School, Gales School in Gortowling. Huge effort made to reconfiguring the schools, the huge courage and commitment of teachers in getting children back to school. Clearly, as I said, our aim as a broader society aim is that we keep this critical element of children's development active and running. If I could touch on that point again, Claire, going back to that report we got working with the paediatricians, we saw that during that lockdown, great harm, especially to children with special needs. We saw elements of regression, and especially with primary school children whose capacity to self-direct and to keep learning and to keep focusing is much more hampered than secondary school.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So let's
we were all there.
It's while I understand many of the questions you and your colleagues pose quite rightly are based on linear risks and viewpoints, we must think of off-the-counter risks.
Okay, so your view is keep them open for as long as is possible?
Yes, because I think in this second phase, we're fighting not just to flatten the virus, we're fighting to keep healthcare services open, we're fighting to keep schools
education
open too.
The GAA, the National League, due to resume this weekend. In the context of what you've just told me over the last 15 minutes or so, it would not seem like a sensible thing to do.
Well, first of all, I would like to acknowledge something positive with the GAA to take an opportunity, as I always have to when I get an interview, and that is the GAA has made an enormous contribution to the care of older people during the lockdown. I don't know if you saw the infographic they distributed, that for people in isolation, cocooned, the GAA played an enormous right across the country.
And they're in a really tight spot here, and it's really difficult for them to make a call on it. But I did see someone on Twitter saying, will someone ever make a call on this? You know, whether it's the GAA, whether it's NEFIT, you know, yourself, somebody tell them what to do. They're in a really difficult position today.
Yes, and there have been scenes that, you know, with sport and with victory comes jubilation and celebration. And we have seen those scenes. And I'm sure the GAA wouldn't stand by those scenes either. And you've seen their own responses on club championships when they saw those scenes themselves. Clearly, the levels in some counties are a concern, particularly my own native counties, native areas, where the border area, where we see very high levels of community transmission. And certainly, when you look at the levels from 3, 4, 5, each one of them has an incremental increased effect and impact on sporting and congregation and games. So, and that will play out, but people will see and know that we, none of us, all of us have an obligation not to suspend our activity or suspend our commitment to that.
So should the National League games go ahead this weekend?
I'm not going to say that now. It's not my decision.
Okay.
But I would say that based on what I've told you from the medical point of view, we have serious concerns about community transmission. And we know that that transmission takes place in congregated settings, particularly indoor, but in other outdoor settings.
Okay, because it was Shane Dowling from the Napiercig and Limerick who said, you know, this should we play or shouldn't we play the championship is getting fair annoying. Can some leader, be it the GAA or government or together ideally, stand up and make a decision based on facts and figures? Do you think that's a fair thing for him to say?
Absolutely fair that it is, and a decision will have to be made. But I would strongly advocate it should be made within that framework, the government framework that was worked out with advice from NPHET, with advice from public health doctors, with advice from the HSE led by Paul Reid. This is the framework, and I believe those decisions should be made within that framework because that's the most consistent message we can give to people.
You mentioned Paul Reid there, and when I was talking to the Taoiseach that now infamous Monday night when he was talking about the NPHET recommendation on the Sunday to go to level 5, he said to me that Paul Reid and the HSE didn't know about this NPHET recommendation, and you were the first person who popped into my head because I thought Colm Henry sits on NPHET. Couldn't have been right.
I sit on NPHET. There's a number of HSE people sitting
there
in NPHET.
I
sit there as a doctor and giving advice in the HSE's perspective. There was a long discussion on that particular Sunday. We were seeing trends which are clear now, and a recommendation came out. Mm-hmm. It's very easy looking at the time and looking back to see how that came as a surprise to people. I would love to sit
but
here.
But you
today.
Surely
I would
told
love to sit
Paul
here
Reid that it was coming.
Obviously,
right?
I have very close discussions with Paul Reid all the time, and we enjoy a very good working relationship. I have great respect for him, the leadership he's shown in the HSE, particularly during this crisis. And he's, I have to say, and I'm saying this publicly, he is at all times listened to very carefully to expert advice or medical advice and considers it very carefully, without exception.
Okay. And were you upset with what the Taoiseach said that night?
It's not my job to be upset about things. And, you know, the way I look at it, the virus doesn't have emotions, so I can't afford to have them either when it comes to tackling the virus.
Okay. Dr. Colm Henry, thank you very much for coming in.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.